This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 72, and this is the first episode of the year 2020. And I want to thank everybody that's listening and supporting the podcast and have supported the podcast over the last few years. Very much appreciated. And here we are starting another year, and I hope to bring you lots of solid content that you're going to get a lot of and find it valuable and informative and all that stuff. So excited about the new year and what it might bring. Anyway, we have a great episode for you today. To start off the year, we're meeting with Dr. Jennifer White, and we're going to be talking about critical suicidology. But before we get there, just a couple of quick announcements, as always. Please, if you could, rate and review the show wherever you might listen to it, on iTunes or what have you. That's a great way for us to get out in front of people, and we would appreciate you. And if you find this of value, please share it. Share it with your colleagues, with your friends. I know a lot of you do, and it's very much appreciated. But if you could, yeah, share it around, that would be great. And also, there's some new YouTube videos up. I don't know if you're following the Radical Therapist YouTube channel, but please go over there. And I got a couple of my student-made videos. We did a project in my last quarter in one of my classes, and some of the students put together some videos, and so that was fun. And if you want to go check those out, those are at the Radical Therapist YouTube channel. So yeah, go check that stuff out. And I have new stickers and I have new t-shirts, so. And I know I got, and I have a list of people I owe stuff to, so that's going to be coming out, I promise. But anyway, okay, so let's get to the show. It's going to be a good one. And Dr. Jennifer White is a professor in the School of Child and Youth Care at the University of Victoria. Jennifer has worked in the human services sector for over two decades, and she has practiced in the field of youth suicide prevention since 1988. Jennifer has worked as a clinical counselor, educator, policy consultant, researcher, and community developer. Jennifer is interested in studying contemporary discourses of youth suicide prevention through critically informed relational approaches to inquiry. She seeks to explore alternatives to the standardized, expert-driven, one-size-fits-all, risk factor-based approach to youth suicide prevention. The idea is not to replace current approaches to prevention, but rather to expand our understandings and vocabularies and allow multiple possibilities and approaches to proliferate. So without further ado, let's meet Jennifer. Hello, Dr. White. Welcome to the Radical Therapist podcast.
Hello. It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay. I guess I was wondering if we could start by maybe having you share a bit about what critical suicidology is and how you found your way into this work.
Sure. Well, I would say it's a fairly new and emerging movement, field, social action. I think it's all of those things. That's a response to what some of us perceive to be some of the limitations of what we would call the kind of mainstream approach to suicide prevention or suicidology. And one of the ways I found my way into it was through my own increasing disenchantment with some of the ideas and some of the practices of suicide prevention. And I worked for a long time as a counselor. I've worked in policy contexts. I've produced documents that kind of cohere with that mainstream approach, where there's a real strong attention to risk and identifying risk within individuals, and a very strong attempt to what I've called kind of tame suicide and to reduce it to something that can be knowable and amenable to kind of standardized interventions. And I think my own dissatisfaction was that it was seeming to be becoming more of a procedural task, It was seeming to create distance between me and the people I was engaged with in conversations about suicide. And there was this idea that, well, if we just have this certain knowledge that we could apply through evidence, right, we could somehow stop people from killing themselves. And so those were some of the early questions I had about what we were doing and how that I found it quite limiting and also not very creative or life affirming, really.
Right. Great. Okay. So, and your work explores these alternatives to biomedical approaches to suicide prevention. And I guess before we get going, could you describe what some of these biomedical approaches are?
Sure. I mean, I think there's been a lot of really good work that's been written about the medicalization of distress, and suicide is no exception to this, that it's as if medicine has claimed authority over knowing about suicide. And one of the consequences of that is that it has become framed as an individual problem that's tightly tethered to psychopathology or mental illness. There's a lot of talk in the field of suicidology that 90% of people who die by suicide meet the criteria for a mental illness or mental disorder. And so this is how it's come to be known. And in many ways, it's an unquestioned or an uninterrogated fact that people sort of start as their departure point and then go from there. And what we're trying to do in critical suicide studies is introduce some questions into that and interrogate that a little bit more.
That's great. Yeah, you have written, while potentially useful to some, the conceptualization of suicide as a regrettable, self-inflicted, intentional, and tragic death that is linked to individual psychopathology is not timeless, universal, or natural, and may actually preclude the consideration of approaches and responses that engage with the cultural and social political context that produce vulnerabilities to suicide. I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
Sure. I think what I have found helpful, and theoretically drawing from ideas of social constructionism or post-structural theory, we come to understand that how we come to know the world is not a given, that it's actually the product of human and social relations, discourse, language, material realities that shape how we understand things. And suicide is no exception. And so to just accept that, oh, it's mental illness, is a disavowal of what we know historically, that there's been many times throughout history where suicide has been thought of as a sin, for example, or suicide was thought of as a crime. And we're now in this era of thinking about suicide as illness. But I think what Ian Marsh writes about the contingency of suicide over time shows that it's not a stable essence and that it can always be thought otherwise. And I think that's the crack and the opportunity to think it otherwise.
Does that make sense? Yeah, no, and I, yeah, and that's what's really interesting to me. And you also, and this is as well, you have written about exploring, which you just touched on, the subjugated meanings of suicide, including, for example, suicide as sin, weapon, freedom, philosophical contemplation, an aesthetic experience. And I'm wondering if you could say more about that. And I imagine that's kind of controversial in some circles.
Indeed. And not just controversial, but in some places unsayable. Right. And I think my colleagues and I who write in this area of critical suicide studies are very interested in those moments where we feel like even uttering this feels dangerous, or that you're transgressing an important norm that's kind of governing how we're to talk and think about suicide. So it's true that we have all kinds of categories for thinking about suicide. So some things we put outside the bounds of thinking about it. So we say, well, euthanasia or medically assisted death, that's a different kind of death. Or we say suicide bombers, well, that's a different kind of death. That's not what we mean. Or slow suicides that people might be living lives of utter misery and dying in many ways a slow death. Through substance use problems, through disordered eating issues. I mean, all kinds of things that we could think of where people are engaging in acts that lead to their death, but we don't call it suicide. So it's these categories and classifications about what gets included in our understanding that become quite interesting. And so right now we're in this era where we think about suicide as, well, it's this kind of thing that's tethered to depression or anxiety or other kind of mental disorders. And that's the thing that we say is the legitimate focus of suicide prevention. Other kinds of suicides, well, we're not talking about that in this instance. And so I think that's quite interesting.
As do I. That's, yeah. Great. Okay. So yeah, globally, suicides account for a significant number of premature deaths every year. And now in the U.S. at least, we're getting, there's a lot of press around suicide being one of the factors fueling a drop in U.S. life expectancy, which is kind of a new development. And now research is showing these, what they're calling deaths of despair, making inroads into Black and Latinx communities. And the core of your work argues that traditional approaches to research and prevention are not working for everyone. And I'm wondering if you could say some more about that or why this is happening.
Yeah, and I think that that's an important point, is saying that some of these traditional approaches do, in fact, work for some folks, and some people find them very helpful and probably even life-saving. So what we're not doing in critical suicide studies is saying throw all those things out and replace it with this. We're saying let's expand the possibilities for thinking about what suicide is and what suicide prevention might entail. And I think this idea of deaths of despair is a great example of how we need to bring in the political and social and structural context of people's lives when we think about distress. And traditional approaches that kind of narrowly focus just on people's internal psyches as the site for intervention, for example, depression or anxiety, which often get treated with medication, which often get treated with even individual level skill building, like learning to cope better or building up people's resilience. All of these things in many ways obscure the political context that contribute to suffering, whether it's racism, colonization, heteronormativity, white supremacy, unemployment, toxic masculinity. I mean, the list goes on of the kinds of things that are contributing to people's experiences of distress. And what we're saying is let's allow those things to come into the frame when we both try to understand suicide, but also when we try to respond to it.
Yeah, great. You also write about the gendered frameworks of suicide. I wonder if you could say more about that.
Yeah, and there's been quite a bit of very interesting work written by other scholars in this area. I mean, Sylvia Canetto has written about this a lot. Katrina Jaworski wrote a book on gender and suicide. And again, there's this paradox that's apparent in suicide research where men and boys tend to kill themselves more often, but girls and women are identified as engaging in more non-fatal suicidal behaviors. And I think what Jaworski is trying to show is often the way we think about what suicide is also influenced by masculinist readings of what suicide means. And so what she would give as examples is it's often been talked about as suicide is something that men do because they're more autonomous, they're more goal-directed, they're more serious. Women's suicidal behavior gets often framed as gestures, not serious, sometimes attention-seeking, or a passive. And even these frames influence what comes to be called suicide and is very much linked to ideas about intentionality. And yet we know that suicide is something that people experience in very profound ambivalent ways. So people have very contradictory ideas about suicide often, where sometimes the very idea of having an escape is the thing that allows someone to live. Right. And we find that these are interesting places to think through different approaches to suicide responses that can engage with these complexities and contradictions and not try to smooth them over.
Great. In your work, you also, and you've touched on this, in your work, you also go beyond just critiquing modern suicidology. Your work proposes alternative approaches that are creative, socially just, and culturally responsive. And I wonder if you could say more about these approaches.
Yeah, and I think, I hope I've kind of hinted at some of these in that.
Yeah, yep.
we definitely want to continue to provide compassionate care to individuals who are struggling and thinking about suicide. I mean, that's definitely something we want to maintain. We want to make sure people have access to high quality mental health care. At the same time, we want to recognize that many people, and particularly young people, do not avail themselves of formal mental health services when they're feeling suicidal. And even if they do show up, they don't necessarily stick around for a long time. And so we need other approaches that can engage with people in the context of their lives, whether it's more informal supports, whether it's through strategies that bring people together in solidarity against some of these forces of oppression. I mean, oftentimes suicide is a statement of resistance to living in these unlivable conditions. Right, and so right. What if we thought about it like that, that it's a response to injustice? And again, there's a lot now more coming out about suicide as a social justice issue. And if we think about it that way, what kinds of interventions and ways of working together that implicate all of us would we consider? So not just individual counseling, although that's important, but there's a whole other range of things that engage communities and social relations to live differently together.
Yeah, great. Okay. Laura Delano has written that when suicide is seen as something to be prevented, honest listening, which to me means listening without needing to act and without needing to find an immediate answer, is deemed irresponsible or even dangerous. And your work wrestles with how might we reflexively engage with these paradoxes and contradictions to recognize how we are potentially contributing to the very problems that suicidology has been set up to solve. In the face of this, what might you tell frontline mental health workers how they might better approach this work?
Yeah, I really appreciate Laura Delano's work and other folks who identify themselves as either psychiatric survivors or people with lived experience or experts by experience, because their experience of the mental health system tells us so much about the things that might be not just not helpful, but actually harmful to people's mental health. And I think her quote there about where listening is deemed dangerous highlights the fact that the minute suicide enters the conversation for many clinicians, what I have experienced and what I've heard others tell me is that people flip into this other mode. And mode is like instantaneous, where we start thinking about risks and we start thinking about liability and we start thinking about containment and safety and all of the work we've done to create this relational engagement and the possibility for exploring everything, including people's desires for suicide, sort of falls away. And all of a sudden, these institutional and organizational requirements have your paperwork in order, for lack of a better word, or to avoid being, you know, seen to be liable. And it then takes the turn of the conversation becoming less engaged with the person's experience and becomes about how are we going to keep you safe and how are we going to contain this scary thing that now has entered the conversation.
Right.
Yeah. And I've actually had some very interesting conversations with mental health clinicians recently as part of some other research, where it's almost as if they understand that the task of risk assessment and safety planning are required by their organizations. And some, I think, find it useful. But at the same time, they realize that that's not always benefiting the client. Those structures and those formats and those risk assessment tools, and that they're then engaging in a different kind of practice. It's almost like they get that out of the way, they produce the documents that's required, and then they sometimes even say things like, and then we get on to the stuff that's really helpful.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a both and thing and learning.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Your work also really works to bring youth voices or insider voices forward in suicide work. And I'm wondering, how do you do that? And what have been the outcomes of these efforts?
Right. So I think what's so important is that we pay attention to whose knowledge And whose experiences are informing the kinds of practices we're engaged in. For the longest time, it was experts and scientists and researchers who were saying these are evidence-based practices, right, and these are best practices. And I think we're becoming more and more aware of the role of folks who've accessed services, so service users and experts by experience, and listening to their voices about what they find helpful and not helpful. And so in talking with young people and in talking with people who've accessed services, sometimes what they tell us about being on the receiving end of a suicide risk assessment is that the questions feel a bit like an interrogation. And they know immediately when the clinician kind of pulls out, even metaphorically or literally, the checklist and the tick boxes, yeah, and, right, you know, are you going to kill yourself, and when are you going to kill yourself, and have you tried to kill yourself, and how and why? And I think we've learned as a suicide prevention community that these are part and parcel of a comprehensive risk assessment. But what we, I think, don't always appreciate is that young people have already been asked those questions several times, sometimes before they've arrived at your office. It's a flat and not very generative conversation.
Right.
And they also have said things like, clinicians in particular, is that these conversations feel kind of deadening in and of themselves, that they don't feel lively, they don't feel surprising, they don't feel fresh, they feel like a kind of a task to get through so that you can kind of get onto something a bit richer and more interesting. So that's some of the information and data that we have from qualitative research about some of the limits of these questions and approaches.
That's great. Okay, I have two final questions for you. And the first one I like to ask folks, and that is, you know, just what ideas or books or films, papers, whatever, are capturing your attention these days? What's got you excited?
Yeah, you know, just over the holidays, I was reading Nicholas Rose's recent book called Our Psychiatric Future. I don't know if you've read it.
I have not.
But he is a sociologist, and he's long studied, you know, he wrote Governing the Soul, and he's written a lot of really interesting books about the times that we're living in. And he has a very strong interest in psychiatry. And he talks very, I think, persuasively about the need for us to rethink what it means to live in these times where so much of what contributes to distress comes out of social adversity. And so that there is a need for us to rethink psychiatry and rethink what we mean by mental well-being, that has, I think, implications for all of us about how we organize our lives and the kinds of ways that we think about responding to others' suffering. So that's been completely inspiring to me, and it's a great text, just came out in 2019. And the other book I've been getting a lot of inspiration from is Amy Chandler's book. She writes a lot about self-injury and medicine and the medicalization of self-injury or self-harm. She's at the University of Edinburgh and is doing an interesting critique there of the medicalization of self-injury. And so, like suicide, self-injury isn't one singular thing. And she draws into that frame all of the things people engage in, whether it's piercings or tattooings or other kinds of things. And so it's not just one thing. And it's also quite a gendered kind of discourse around self-injury. So she, I think, interviews folks who've engaged in self-harming practices and also comes up with some different ways of thinking about it that go beyond a medical kind of biomedical pathological frame. So her work's also really interesting to me and worth a look too.
Wonderful. And I'll be sure to check out. I'm familiar with Nicholas Rose's work, but I haven't read that book. So I'll be sure to check out both of those. So thank you for that. And my final question is, I know listeners might want to find you, find your work. How might they do that?
Well, a couple of ways. I mean, we do, the Critical Suicide Studies Network does have a website. So criticalsuicidestudies.net, I think, is the address. I'll make sure I send it to you so you have
Please. That one. And I'll put it on the show notes. Yep.
Fabulous. And there's a number of papers and books that many of us have published to show that this is an intellectual movement that's building, and there's activists and scholars and folks with lived experience who were really interested in becoming part of this network. We're hosting a conference in Vancouver in June, the Critical Suicide Studies Conference. That's the theme is creating worlds worth living in.
Mm.
So you can already see the shift and the attention paid to the context and not the persons as the site of intervention.
Mm.
We've created a set of ethics to guide our work as critical suicide studies scholars that we want to make public and be transparent about. So that's also on the website, which includes turning the critical gaze on ourselves and not becoming just another little monolithic entity with borders that are impenetrable. So I think this is also an interesting time for us as a field, because when you're kind of coming from the margins to critique the center, you don't want to then become the very thing that you're kind of troubled by with the mainstream.
For sure, yeah.
So how do we keep this critical edge alive? How do we become inclusive? How do we stay open to our own limitations? And there's also been some great writing recently by an author named Tack, who talks about the imperative to think about prevention as if living is the natural state of humans. And so she does this really interesting thing that even in suicide prevention, we assume that to live and to endure in some dire circumstances is the correct desirable state. And so she does some very interesting things even with that, the idea of prevention itself.
Hmm.
She's taking a questioning approach to, which I've appreciated.
Wonderful. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Jennifer, thank you for coming on and making the time. This has been wonderful. And thanks for sharing your experience with us.
Thanks for your interest, Chris. I really appreciate the chance to have the conversation with you today.
Great. Thank you.
Take care.
All right. That's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. Very much appreciated. And please come follow us on all the socials, The Rad Therapist at Twitter, The Radical Therapist on Instagram, and we got a Facebook page. Come find The Radical Therapist on Facebook. Be part of the community. And go follow us on socials. And like I said earlier, if you could, we'd very much appreciate you rating and reviewing the show, sharing it with your friends, tagging us even, tagging The Radical Therapist, hashtagging The Radical Therapist, what have you. That would be very much appreciated. And like I said, excited about the new year, and bringing you new content. And hopefully you'll just keep hanging in there with us. So as always, my name is Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist. Thanks for listening.